Hello, hello, and you're listening to The Lit Pickers, and I am here with
Supriya Nair, and I am here with
Dipanjana Pal. Mm-hmm. We are here to nitpick about literature and to talk about books and reading and generally bring you in on the chats that we tend to have while we're having breakfast.
Mm. Brunch, well, right.
Usually.
We're going to go have momos after this in case anyone's feeling hungry.
But before that,
Let's actually talk about the thing that we're here to talk about.
Which is books. And I wanted to ask you, Miss Nair, do you remember the first book you read?
In my life?
In your life.
Yeah, it was a waterproof book whose title I can't remember, but it was about a penguin in the Arctic.
And how old were you?
I was three. Mm. And I remember that the penguin got into trouble over an iceberg and then got over it quite quickly. And I remember splashing about with it in my little plastic tub and enjoying it very much. Books with more words than pictures in them. Mm. Does Noddy count?
Of course.
Noddy has more pictures than words, right?
No, I don't think so. I think it's quite even Stevens there. I was asking that because for me, the first book that I remember is actually Noddy.
Wow, how predictable are we?
I know. Well, it just tells you how few books you could actually get in English at that point of time.
Right. We're both off a certain age.
Yeah. But no, the reason why I was asking you, actually come to think of it, the first thing I remember reading is actually, this will truly date me, the Illustrated Weekly of India.
Mm.
The reason why I was asking is that Noddy is the book which I remember having picked out on my own and read. And it's the book that I would go back to truly for decades when I felt like I need to kickstart reading again because everything around me is just too horrible and I can't finish the Tolstoy or whatever. I would go back to Noddy.
How does someone like you, who is an inveterate reader, a writer of multiple books, and a reviewer and a critic, have to restart a reading habit? I just assumed you'd be reading all the time.
I think I've been lucky enough, like you, to find work that allows me to read on the job. Mm-hmm. But I think that's also really damaging in many ways because you start looking at it as work as opposed to just reading for fun.
Oh, I 100% look at reading as work. And right? I can't remember the last book I read for fun.
So Penguin Book would have been a book that you read for fun. Noddy was a book that you read for fun.
Mm.
Have you ever had patches when you're like, I can't read?
Yes, a lot. And I think that reading for work helps you forget that, you know, you're supposed to be reading for joy.
Mm.
And there are times when the joy just gets sucked out of reading. I know that for a lot of our listeners, another huge obstacle when it comes to their reading habit is distraction, which is a problem that I don't necessarily feel applies to me.
I don't think either of us are very representative that way.
Yeah.
Though, that said, I guess a lot of it also depends on whether you would consider reading on the internet reading. Because this is a conversation that I've had with a friend who says that for her, one of the ways she gets back to reading is through reading on the internet.
What does she read on the internet?
So she'll read these, these short stories that are done online. There's a lot of creative writing that is done. People do fiction on Instagram. People do strings of writing on message boards. And there's that fan fiction archive, which I'm forgetting the initials of right now.
Archive of our own.
Hmm. Stuff
so
like
reading
this.
Fan fiction,
so
for
reading
example.
Fan
sure.
fiction, which yeah. doesn't technically. So in her head, she was like, I'm not reading. I'm reading fan fiction.
Mm.
In my head, though, that's full on reading.
It is. And it is actually easier because what you're reading is something that takes off on a text that I presume you already know.
Mm.
So if it's fan fiction about like two characters in Harry Potter,
mm-hmm.
you don't have to do the work of immersing yourself in the universe because you already know the universe pretty well. Instead, what you get, I suppose, is like a cool story about what happened to these characters you're already familiar with. And that can kind of be easy, which is not to say anything about the quality of the writing or
which
whatever.
Is sometimes great and
sure.
sometimes atrocious.
And I think sometimes you also do need to read atrocious writing, right? One of the things that I know tends to get people back into a reading habit and which has done so in the past for me, though it doesn't anymore, is romance novels.
Mills and Boons.
Right. Some of them are atrociously written. Some of them are exquisitely written.
Mm-hmm.
But all of them follow a formula which makes kind of the cognitive load of getting into them a bit lighter because you know that it will fulfill certain expectations that you have.
And fundamentally, I feel like in a lot of the sort of social conversations that happen around reading, books are supposed to do things for you, right? Like they're supposed to be a tangible, good result for reading. So you will become smarter. You will become more empathetic. You will become like, you know, because there's this constant project to say that, you know what, this is not just wasting your time.
Right. A book is a way to improve your life.
Yeah. Improve your soul, your intellect, your, I don't know, you levitate at the end of reading 300 pages of Dostoevsky. Why am I going after the Russians today? Anyway.
I don't think Dostoevsky's ever written a short novel.
None of the Russians did. Long Winters,
no,
Vodka.
Gogol. No, anyway. Gogol did. Gogol.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Maybe he wrote them outside Russia. No, no, no. That's
And of course, Chekhov wrote short stories.
I'm not going to get... Well, he was a doctor. He didn't have enough time to write a novel.
Bulgakov. anyway, all right. Let's... moving on. Coming back to South Asia.
Yeah. I'm going to stop
where the weather's better.
Where the weather's better and there are more distractions. But
Nabokov, but I guess he was Russian-American.
Nabokov was not writing in Russia. He didn't have that much vodka.
In fact, he never wrote. His whole career was possible because
he was
they
an
kicked
emigre.
Him out of Russia. Yeah. Sorry.
Anyway, but actually Nabokov is a really good example of the kind of literature that we are encouraged to read, right? Mm-hmm. It's high concept. It's very beautiful. It's very well and intelligently constructed. Mm. And that's the kind of book that you are told will make you a better person by the end of it, whether or not it actually does. Mm-hmm. Those are not the books that for me have ever worked in terms of restarting, even though Nabokov is actually someone I absolutely love, especially because when I'm reading for work, I'm reading a lot of heavy stuff most of the time. It feels so counterintuitive to pick up high art at that point of time, you know, and I say high art with full rabbit ears around
She made rabbit ear quotes.
Vague rabbit ears.
While she was talking.
But young adult fiction, for instance, written so fluently, so lightly, not necessarily full of tropes like romance novels, for example, but still very easy reads, you know. You can finish a young adult novel in a day. And I feel like that's another thing that makes it easier to return to reading. When you finish a book, there's that little bit of an endorphin rush kind of thing of having finished it.
Right. It's another check mark on your Goodreads list or whatever.
However you know, rank
or,
it.
A picture for your Bookstagram.
Oh. Have you done a Bookstagram ever?
I tried to keep one for 2019 because I thought that it would be a good way to record how many books I read. And then I just, I think I stopped posting on it on January 15th.
That went well.
Yeah, it was a private locked account. I thought if I do this properly, then I'll like, I'll unlock it in December. Didn't work. Let's hope 2020 is better than 2019.
So have you
respect.
Tried one for this year?
I would prefer not to say. Ooh. I don't know what you're talking about.
No comment.
So what I'm hearing from you, Dipanjana, is that one of the important things about rediscovering a love of reading and kickstarting a reading habit is to let go of the guilt that surrounds the idea of books and reading. And I think that's very important. And one of the attendant problems of a world in which we kind of quantify our reading by keeping lists and making Goodreads accounts and making Bookstagrams and stuff is that you then become very conscious of what you read because it feels like you have to tabulate. Yeah, you have to tabulate it and then you have to show it to someone.
Which will then get you likes on dislikes. So there's a level of performance to this which I think a lot of people feel a little uncomfortable about, right?
But life is not an exam, you know? So the two things to remember is that you can read what you want because no one's going to quiz you on it. And you can stop reading whatever you don't want to read, which is also something a lot of people have trouble with.
Just
give up a book that you don't need to read like freely. So I sometimes do a Q&A about books and reading on my Instagram, like kind of infrequently whenever I have the time. And one question I get a lot is, hey, I've just like stopped reading. What do I do? And one of the things I find quite that and the sincerest and the easiest answer that I can give people is to get back into reading by reading poetry, which ties back in, I think, to what your friend said about internet reading in some ways, because poetry is enjoying an unexpected kind of millennial reformatting because so many people are producing it online and on Instagram in particular. But I also think that if you can afford to, buying a book of poetry and spending some time in it is really helpful, right? Mm. Because a poem doesn't take as long to read as a novel. But you have to plunge yourself into it, heart and mind.
Mm.
And even if you've only read a poem a day, it doesn't take a lot out of your day. But you have done exactly what it is you take to reading for, which is to escape, like not in some, you know, not in some mean, flimsy way, but like in a really meaningful way to like step parallelly into a different universe and imagine something different and like use your heart and mind in a way that you wouldn't outside of a book. And then you step out of it and you feel refreshed. And I think this is true of a lot of people who don't have a reading habit at all, right? That they
Absolutely.
Find it easier to read poetry than other kinds of work.
Yeah, and I think poetry gets a very bad rep by those who have not read that much poetry.
Yeah,
of being difficult to access,
yeah.
Which is not true.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure many poets are.
Of course, but by that logic, there's many things of everything, you know.
That's true. Novels aren't particularly...
They're not easily accessible.
Yeah.
I've not been able to finish a Chetan Bhagat, who's supposed to be the most accessible of novelists.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean... Access and accessibility are very subjective things.
Yeah.
But
one day someone's going to give you a Chetan Bhagat to review and then you're really going to be in trouble.
I will not be having momos that day.
Mm.
So here's the thing. I have a very diverse taste in books. And like I was saying, the high art stuff is not what I will go to restart my reading habit or even to read for fun, quite
sure.
frankly.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of a long day... I don't think I'd be picking up, I don't know, An American Marriage, for mm-hmm. example, which is a brilliant novel.
Mm-hmm.
But oh my God, I want to slit my wrists practically every paragraph, right?
I see.
Despite how beautifully written and moving it is.
Right.
What I'd want to go to bed with is possibly a Mills and Boon.
Right.
Right. Or that quick, fun read from... I don't know, a murder mystery, for example, again, right. goes quickly.
Note to listeners, Dipanjana Pal has written a thriller herself.
That's true.
That includes...
And it will not keep you awake at night.
Right. It does include some murder, right?
Well, in a manner of speaking. I mean, right. there's feticide, so...
Right.
Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah.
But actually, it's funny that you mentioned the book. It didn't strike me until you just said it, that when I was writing it, I was very conscious that I didn't want it to be a literary fiction novel.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted it to be an easy read.
Right.
I think we forget that poets are not writing to be inaccessible to readers, but quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you were recommending someone start reading poetry,
mm-hmm.
would you suggest going for an anthology mm-hmm. or like individual poets' books?
I think if it was someone I knew well enough to recommend a poet to them, mm. I would.
Mm.
But on Instagram, it's impossible to do that, right?
Mm.
I think an anthology is a great idea, in fact, because you don't know what you're going to get. I have an underrated anthology called These My Words,
oh.
which was edited by Eunice D'Souza, among others,
oh,
and
lovely.
Is an anthology of Indian poetry from, you know, across the ages. It's a single volume paperback, and I've just found so much surprising stuff in it.
Oh,
and it
lovely.
Varies in quality and subject, of course, but... you know, if something like that, if you just discover something that you've never read before, someone you've never read before, how wonderful is that, right? I mean, you're right. Okay, some poets maybe do write to, if not to be inaccessible, then to be accessible only to, you know, a very narrow circle of other readers that they're thinking about, and that's fine. But poetry is not supposed to be difficult. Like, if you give it the gift of your attention, it is supposed to make something accessible to you that you previously thought inaccessible. So
or
really, it's
put,
the opposite.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or put to words things that you weren't able to put to words yourself. A feeling that you have that you didn't know how to articulate. Somebody else does that for you.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons why it seems to be slightly vague. There's enough space to fill yourself in those spaces.
Yeah.
Something else that I turn to a lot when I feel like, you know, the other stuff isn't quite holding my attention. Because I think for me, it's not like I can't read, but that I'm just not enjoying it or I'm not focusing on it. It's like I see the letters, but nothing's actually making sense. Science fiction. Mostly fantasy, actually. Let me rephrase that. Science fiction turns me off, like when it's science heavy, mostly.
Sure.
But that's because I have half a brain that just doesn't work, like fully humanities oriented. Fantasies, on the other hand.
I mean, it says a lot about the kind of science fiction that gets attention or that used to get attention in a certain time in our literary history, which
because
was,
it was for
written
boys.
By, which was written by bad writers who wanted to force fit their ideas about technology or science into kind of very clumsy narratives. Yeah, so that's the problem.
Yeah.
Not that humanity's brain, you know, can't understand.
So I think for me,
I mean, you know, you don't need to, like, what is there to understand about, like, time warps? They don't exist, okay? So, except maybe to a few scientists at CERN right now. So it's your job to, like, freaking convince me, you know? I mean, I hate genre snobs as much as I hate literary fiction snobs. Like, get over yourselves.
There's a massive snobbery surrounding most genre fiction.
Yeah, and it's so copycat, like, masculine whiteness.
Yes.
And there are a lot of Indian men, or there were a lot of Indian men I used to meet who had it or who borrowed it from abroad. I don't know what they're doing now. I just stopped talking to people like that. So
hopefully they got better taste in reading and writing. But so I found myself gravitating more towards the fantasy side of science fiction writing. And that, again, is incredibly freeing because, it yes, a lot of this genre fiction does have tropes. Mm-hmm. It's true. But by the same token, it literally sets up new worlds for you, right? And so then, even though I think if you start thinking about these stories, there's a lot of parallels with your everyday life sometimes or with things that are happening in other countries. Like, for example, today, not today, but in the last couple of years, we've had a lot of conversation about something like The Handmaid's Tale coming across not as a dystopia, but as a contemporary reality for a lot of people in America, at least, and North America. But it was imagined as something that was not happening right now. Actually, Atwood does this a lot, right? Oryx and Craig, that whole Mad Adam trilogy, she took elements from stuff that was actually happening and then put it all together to talk about things like climate change, to talk about fastly polarizing societies. And yet they're being done in a context that doesn't feel immediately recognizable, so you don't feel burdened by it.
So tell me what you like about young adult fiction. That's not something I read a lot of. Like, is Harry Potter young adult fiction?
Yes, Harry Potter is very much young adult fiction. I think the first of the Potters was children's fiction, but books have grown with the characters and the readers.
Sure.
So by the time you've reached the third or fourth book, it's very much in young adult zone.
Sure.
Children of Blood and Bone by Tomi Adeyemi, second part has just come out in 2020. Nevermore, a series of, again, kind of Harry Potter inspired in that it's an alternative magical world. Fantastic series. Philip Pullman. You must have read Philip Pullman, have you not?
Yeah, I have. I have.
Dark Materials.
Yeah.
That's very much young adult. I think Dark Materials is actually a great example of the kind of young adult fiction I enjoy.
I guess I think of all of this as fantasy. Although my friend Alok argues that Harry Potter is science fiction and not fantasy because science fiction is always set in the future, while fantasy is about reconstructing the past.
And Harry Potter is reconstructing the past?
And Harry Potter is not reconstructing the past. Anyway, so, okay, so young adult fiction needn't necessarily be fantasy, but a lot of young adult fiction is about imagining a new universe.
In among Indian writers, I think you have a lot of non-fantasy young adult fiction, like Himanjali Sarkar's work. Nothing fantastical about it, but looks at issues of identity, self-identification, and in really interesting, unpreachy ways.
Right. Meenakshi Reddy Madhavan is another author who's written for younger readers. Right.
Shabnam Minwala, whose stuff I absolutely adore, though hers has some of this magic stuff shoved in there.
Okay.
So I think what works beautifully for young adult writing, in terms of those of us who are not technically young adult anymore by a long shot, it's non-preachy.
Right.
It's undemanding. It's very clear that it has a story to tell, right? And that story has priority over messaging, et cetera, et cetera. The messaging is important for a lot of writers.
Right.
I mean, they are being quite responsible.
I mean, these are all, at least the ones you've mentioned, are all deeply moral books, right? Rowling is a moralist. Pullman is a moralist.
Yes. I think from the Indian...
The Hunger Games is a very moralistic
work. Which I've never read, actually, but I've...
From what I've heard of it.
Yeah, I've heard it's very moralistic.
And maybe there's something to that, that existing in a universe where you're immersed in a great story, but you're also reminded of what's right and you feel like it's easy to take a side.
Yeah. It simplifies the world for you in some ways.
Yeah.
Without losing nuance. Like good young adult fiction.
So in that sense, it clarifies rather than simplifies the world for you. And that can sometimes be helpful. I mean, I suppose this can backfire in its ways, right? There are a lot of people who complain about the fact that young people in the UK and US today can't seem to interpret politics except through the prism of like Death Eaters and Voldemort and whatever, which is horrible, of course. I think it's rubbish too. But it's not unimportant that people have like a shared imaginative language in which that's kind of shorthand for them to be able to talk about this stuff. Just like I suppose The Handmaids, whom you brought up earlier, becomes shorthand for a whole complex of issues surrounding women and the patriarchy. So it's not necessarily, I mean, I think maybe that what we miss in these conversations is that, yes, it can be irritating for someone who hasn't read the work or who doesn't like it. But for a lot of people, it's a way to talk to each other in a clarifying language rather than in a complicated one.
And it's that lack of complicatedness as opposed to complexity. Mm-hmm. There are very complex ideas being discussed, but in uncomplicated manner. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes these books easy to read, not necessarily easy to absorb.
Sure.
That, I think, takes longer. Mm-hmm. But because it'll go by quickly, A, you get that old endorphin rush that we were talking about, but also it stays with you. So it just lingers in your head for a bit, and then you'll start thinking of one character having said one thing. So, you know, in the age of the internet, there's this whole thing of quotations is something that has gained currency, right? They're little pieces of works, whether it's a poem or it's a novel or it's a play or whatever, that will circulate because that one fragment suddenly seems to apply like a piece of glass, like catching light. It applies to so many things. That's what happens with young adult fiction very easily because that settles into you so quickly. Ultimately, I think for restarting a reading habit, that's the most important part. How quickly can you finish the book? If you can't finish the book quickly, if it requires you to stay with it for a really long period of time, for me, that just doesn't work. I'm happy to go back to books that are long and dense and reread them often in patches, like, I don't know, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. That's a book that I went back to a lot, particularly because I don't know if you remember, but it had a full alternative story about fairyland happening in the footnotes.
Yeah, I read about a third of the book. I haven't actually finished it, but I do know about the footnotes.
So did you not finish it because you didn't like it or because you lost
I just
track?
Couldn't get into it.
I couldn't get out of it.
Yeah, and there's a time for every book, I think, in our lives, right? So trying to kickstart a reading habit with a very difficult book or a book that you have previously imagined is very difficult can sometimes be the way to crack it. I had an extended period of, so like Dipanjana said earlier in the episode, when your work involves reading books, it's very difficult to stop reading entirely. But, you know, it can really take the joy out of reading for you. And one of the things that happened to me after an extended period of time when I simply felt that no book that I was reading was able to like touch my heart or my consciousness in a meaningful way, I actually decided to sail into War and Peace.
Oh, wow.
And the thing that most people don't realize about Tolstoy is that he is actually so easy to read. A critic once famously said that the book seems to be reading itself when you read it. And that's true of both his major novels. The thing about War and Peace, though, is that it's very long, right?
Yeah.
Which is what is daunting about it. And it took me, I think, fully a year to get through it in between all the other reading that was going on. And it was so rewarding to me because it just felt like for the time that I was reading the book, whether it was by a poolside or at a pedicure or in a train, it really felt like instead of being on land, I was in water. And that was the power of it. And, you know, and then there was a sort of purpose to it. Not only did I want to go back to the book because I wanted to know what was happening to the characters, I also wanted to finish it. And sometimes having that sort of purpose driving you can be really helpful.
Ultimately, though, I do want to ask you the question, device or book, do you think one or the other makes a difference?
Yeah, I do. In fact, I'm 100% sure it differs for different people, right? I was brought up reading physical books. Mm. And so to go back to a physical book for me means that my attention knows that it's wanted in a way that it doesn't necessarily know when I'm reading on a phone or a device. But of course, if you, the thing that you're most familiar with is your iPad, you know, if you first started reading on a Kindle app on your phone, then maybe that's the thing that will. So I think it's about first, it's about like formative experiences in some ways.
So
what do you think?
I can't read on the phone, right? I've tried. Mm. I absolutely cannot read on the phone.
I wouldn't be able to write my column if they didn't make books for phones. But right.
So yeah, I have no idea why. I can't break this down psychologically, but the whole thing of just the phone size of text is not enough for me. Mm. And I immediately get distracted. And by the end of that paragraph, I have already gone to Instagram, I think.
Right, because a phone is supposed to be distracting, right?
I guess.
We do switch back and forth between email and Twitter and whatever.
Yeah.
So why would a book be any different?
So it doesn't matter whether I've, you know, turned off notifications, all that stuff. I just can't seem to read on the phone. Because I've realized the thing for me is that I don't read in small spurts, right? When I read, I'm kind of consumed by what it is that I'm reading. Mm. Whether or not it necessarily deserves all of my brain, I am giving it to it.
Of course.
But the Kindle for me, the device itself, not the app, the Kindle has been, for me, the best thing when it comes to restarting reading. Mm-hmm. I think I'm very attached to the physical book as the book that I sort of hold on to and stay with. Mm. But for quick reads, I'm absolutely devoted to my Kindle. And I think with the Kindle, what really also helps me is that it's told me how much of the book is left without actually it being a tangible thing, like a physical thing. Like when you're reading a book,
right,
it's not 20% left, right?
Right.
It's a weight in your hands
right.
that's left.
Right.
It's an amount of, it's a thickness between your fingers that's
right.
left. Somehow, 20% left, 80% left. That just feels more insubstantial and less of a pressure for me.
Right. And
it's
of course,
like,
the tiny psychological benefit that Amazon games you with is that you always finish the book sooner than the estimated time that they tell you it'll take.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Which
but
is very
also,
devious.
But, the thing is that I can't compute numbers. So for me, 80% is like, oh, okay, I have no idea what that actually means.
You're like, that's a figure.
It's a figure,
right.
which I'm entirely ignoring and going back to where I was.
Well, I hope some of this has helped our readers feel a little less disheartened about not reading, if that's what you did all through last year. And I hope you can begin your new year with a Kindle or a phone or whatever other device you're used to using and to find a book that you like.
And a story that appeals to you. Because ultimately, that's all your reading habit is waiting for.
Yeah.
The right story. And it is out there.
Yeah. In the end, you're the only person to whom that book matters. You know, whether or not you're going to put a picture of it with a mug of coffee on Instagram. So I urge you not to worry too much about it. If you think that Dipanjana or I can help you with a book recommendation, we are happy to try. So come find us on Twitter and Instagram and tune in to our next episode. Thank you very much for listening to this one. We will say bye for now.
This is a Made in India production. The editorial producers are Mae Thomas and Sean Phantom. Shania Subramanian is our producer and the assistant producer is Janam Devan. These episodes are edited by Vijay Doifure and recorded by Adriel George, as well as the Island City Studio. Our theme music is Here's to You by the Easy Wanderlings.